Good morning, everybody, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. My name's Mike Salthouse. I work for a P&I club, North Standard, which is one of the larger clubs in the international group. And P&I clubs, of course, are mutual associations of ship owners. And being mutuals, we have on our board lots of ship owner members. And a few years ago, that board comprised of individuals like Dr. Nasser Bettaini of the Islamic Republic of Iran Shipping Lines. It also had Captain Sliwa Michael, who was an Iraqi Christian working for the world's largest Jewish-Israeli shipping group. And alongside them sat Lord Nicholas Fairfax, who represented the Russian tanker owner Sovcomflot. What a great advertisement for all that we've been talking about over the last few days, which is, of course, free trade triumphing over politics, economics, and religion. Sadly, those individuals are no longer on the board of the club, or probably many, many clubs, with the exception, obviously, of the of Captain Michael. And really, over the last few years, really over the, since World War II, we've seen a period of unparalleled economic growth. Since, you know, the last 60 years, annual growth has been around about, worldwide, has been about 2.5%, probably double in this particular region. We've seen the systematic dismantling of trade barriers. We've seen the promotion of free trade agreements, the European Union. And then, of course, technology, the one that everybody talks about, but I always describe it as the elephant in the room because we're not quite sure what's going to happen there. But with technology, my experience of it is that it has promoted productivity. It has made things easier. My job's become easier because of technology. That was the world that we all grew up in. We're now looking forward to the world that the new generation of leaders are going to move into. And that is what this section is actually about. And just to make quite clear, when we deal with 90% of the world's trade, tariffs, sanctions, are always going to impact this particular industry. When it comes to decarbonisation, let's not beat about the bush. We're required to move from a fuel that's widely available with a developed infrastructure into trying to make guesses about what fuel we're going to use in the future, where there is no infrastructure and it's less efficient, with the exception of nuclear, and maybe Bud, with his experience, might say a few words about that. And then technology. Technology so far has complemented what we do, but now it has the potential to disrupt our industry, to disrupt the way in which we run our businesses on the shoreside, the way in which ships are operated, the role of the crew. It's going to, you know, these are real challenges that we're actually going to face. So we've assembled a panel of leaders, and they're going to talk about leadership through transformation. And I'd like, I suppose, us to sort of deal really with three issues, which is, you know, what does leadership in the next 20, 30 years going to look like if this industry is to continue to thrive? Is it happening? Do we see the signs of it happening? And I'm going to ask you all at the end, as I you know, just to give me sort of one thing that you would really like to see change if the industry is to be successful as it sort of engages in this sort of period of transformation. So let's start then. I'm going to ask you all the three the same sort of questions. Looking at your industries, do you think, or your particular sector of the industry, do you think, we'll start with Mr. Grimaldi perhaps, obviously chairman of the ICS and from the group that bears your name, do you see sufficient long-termism in the industry to sort of really address these sorts of challenges?
Yes, thank you very much. And thank you, Nicholas, for having me here. Great pleasure and honor to be here. This was an extremely interesting week in Hong Kong. Coming to this interesting question, our sector is a long-term sector because our investments are huge. And the vessel life, it's a generation, 20, 25 years for a ship. So we have to think long term. There's no other way than thinking long term. That doesn't mean that we can do things also short term. So basically, the most important thing, and we saw this also from the NV, are the investment in new ships. And the investment in new ships, we have to think very long term. We have to think first to save a lot of bunker with the new ships, and this is happening. And of course, this means also less externalities. Our new car carriers, and of course the one of my colleagues, I have some here in this room today, are 100 times better than the past. A car carrier of 4,000 car capacity was emitting just as much as a new car carrier of 9,000 capacity. So the new ships are emitting 100% less than the old ship per car transport. And that is already a big achievement. We saw that probably 16% of the achievement that has to happen for 2030 will come from energy saving, and probably bigger ships and economies of scale and so on, and new technology. Then, of course, short term, we can do a lot as well, and that mainly is retrofits to our ships. Probably a wrong propeller can mean that you consume 20-25% more, probably because she was built for the fastest speed and it's not the cruising speed of the ship. So that can reduce dramatically. Again, there are the bubbles that you can have under the keel that can produce a 7% saving. A better the ducktail, a better hydrodynamics in general. So there are lots of ways to reduce, even with retrofits on the ships, and act short term to get some improvement. But I think that, of course, we have to look at the long term solution, and the long terms come with the investment. And of course, we have also to look at our ships also, what will be the fuel of the future. So most of the ships, even if these fuels are not ready, they will be compatible with the new engines, with new solutions. They could be ammonia, they could be methanol, they could be other different solutions. But I think this will come. And of course, it is not anymore an effort only of the shipping industry, but we need to have the bunkering companies on board, the ports on board. We need to have the shipyards, the companies that produce the engine, and not only. And of course, with this new fuel are also a huge opportunity for the shipping industry, because these new fuels will have to be transported. The other thing that I think we also have to look and we have to invest is not only on the ships and the hardware, but also on the people, because the seafarers need an upskilling. These new skills, this new technology will bring also the necessity of formation on these new fuels, because every new fuel will bring also new risks. And of course, with this new technology, we have to invest also a lot in educating the seafarers. And I think this also, it is unfair to remain a cost for the seafarers. This cost must be taken on board by the nationalities, the countries, but also the ship owners have to contribute definitely to the training of the seafarer. In every other sector of the business, we are always paying for the training, the entrepreneurs. So I don't see why this should not happen as well for the seafarers. Thank you.
Thank you. Bud, maybe we could go to you. So Bud Dahr, Executive Vice President of MSC, obviously responsible for external affairs and also your government engagement. You're also, I think, a nuclear engineer, and you're also commenting really on the scale of the investment that MSC is making in new fuels, new technologies going forward. I'd be interested, though. I mean, do you see that? I mean, how do MSC is one group. I mean, I think you're the world's largest ship owner. But for the industry generally, do you see? Are you encouraged by the long-termism in the industry, or do you really, or are you concerned that there is still some insufficient foresight in the way in which these problems that we outlined at the start are being addressed?
Yeah, well, thank you, and good morning, everyone. And I echo Manuel's comments. It's really a pleasure to be here, so thank you for the opportunity. First of all, just address the first point, and you asked about leadership. And I think in general, as a rule of leadership, leaders have to lead. And if you don't find yourself willing to be leading, don't call yourself a leader. And I think all of us that have been involved in this community will honestly tell each other, 5 years ago, we were not leaders in this space. We still had significant numbers of ship owners in our community and, you know, thought leaders too, because they were dealing with the practical reality that really were kind of in denial that this was going to be a necessity at all. And then it turned into, well, how can we make it workable? And now we are leading. And we have gone from being an industry that was a bit far behind to an industry that is ahead of the curve and trying to make this happen every single day. You asked me the question about what we're doing. I think Manuel talked about what his company is doing. And we currently have an order book that includes over 100 dual-fuel ships on order right now, and we've got about 24 on the water right now. Currently, we're playing the hand that we're dealt, which is we can get fossil LNG today, and we see in the near term having bio-LNG available. It's available in some markets right now, particularly if you don't have to put the physical molecules on board. It's just very expensive, and we do think that there will be synthetic methane in the future. So that is a pathway there, but we don't stop there. And don't be misled by the fact that we have a large commitment towards LNG-fueled ships, that we see that as the only path, because we're actually very open-minded. It's just, let's face it, the availability at scale and marketability of green methanol molecules or green ammonia molecules is something much further downrange right now on the fuel production and delivery side. The commitment from the ship owners is pretty clear. And if you look at it combined with our cruise division, because we are also the world's third biggest cruise line as well as the world's largest liner ocean carrier, we have commitments, you know, tens of billions of dollars in building ships today for fuels that we are hoping come to market tomorrow. And we're not sitting back on our hands. We're working with the energy providers, and I'm sure all the other responsible companies are doing that, to try and not only signal demand, but find ways that we can partner to not only get those fuels developed and produced, but get them delivered through a midstream that in some cases doesn't exist and actually turn in to fuel on board the ships. So if you look at where we are today, I mean, think about it. Our global regulator, we're lucky to have a global regulator, and I think we all need to be supportive of their efforts and encourage governments to put aside their political differences and give us the framework we need for a level playing field that is fit for purpose, not only to help us hit the net zero for 2050 target, which, by the way, was ours as an industry a couple of years before governments finally saw the light and came along with us. But also that will function on a practical basis. We do need to support them in doing that. It is an anomaly. I heard Andreas Nordseth say it yesterday. He said, the first time in my career I'm hearing the industry call for regulation. Well, it's not the first time in my career I've seen that, but it is monumental that this industry is saying, give us that framework. Because if you look at the other sectors, you know, are they subject to a global regulatory regime that is mandatory on a global basis? No. Generally speaking, and some of the largest emitters are not at all. Second, is that global regulatory regime, if it exists for anybody else, being modified and strengthened? Well, no, it's not, but ours is. Does the industry support it? Probably not, but ours does. And I see a real bright future here because we are aligned with a 1.5 degree trajectory. That's what the member states said in 2023 through a revised strategy that we fully supported. So I'm very optimistic for the future, but let me be clear. All the best intentions of responsible ship owners like Manuel and the Aponte family that I represent, or those that Martin represents, can buy equipment, but it doesn't make molecules happen of the fuels we will need. Others have to deliver those to the marketplace and allow us to have our share. We'll do our part, and we're doing it today. But without that, this is all a bunch of talk, and it doesn't help in the end. So we must get the fuels, and we need help from governments to incentivize that.
Thanks, Bud. Martin, Dr. Martin Kruger, from the CEO of the German Shipowners Association. You represent actually quite a wide range of shipowners in Germany, and I wonder, are you confident you see sufficient long-termism? I was struck by a comment that came from your counterpart in Malaysia yesterday, where he said, "Look, if we make the wrong choices, we're dead." You know, and I wonder how are your members finding the way to navigate their way through the sort of challenges that they're actually facing now.
That's a very good question. Thank you, and good morning, all. I think the appetite in the German ship-owning community for long-term planning, if we would like to call it like that, is still very strong. But unfortunately, it doesn't only depend on the will of the ship-owning community or the operators of ships if we see innovation on the horizon. It also needs the regulator. And I like what Bud just said, to be a thought leader or to be a leader at all, that, of course, goes for the industry, but it also goes for the regulator, right? We need rather innovative regulation that supports a modern industry to actually come forward with new solutions. And I have the feeling that is one of the most challenging environments, the regulative environment, which is actually challenging the long-term planning of the ship owners in the moment. Mm. Of course, we have the political circumstances, which are influencing long-term planning, but the regulative environment that we are facing with a more regional approach towards regulating an international means of transport, that is actually one of the biggest challenges we face in the moment. So if long-term planning would be much easier for the shipping industry, if states would commit to IMO, and unfortunately they don't on a level that we would need to actually have the optimism of planning long-term. You know, because every time we are faced with the problem, let's take decarbonization as one example, but there are plenty of others, we see good ideas popping up in IMO, how innovative regulation might look like, but then we see certain blocs in the world, especially the European Union, come forward with their own ideas, bring them forward in IMO, and then see, we need to make actually a compromise to introduce international regulation, and they go home and introduce European regulation, which unfortunately, in fact, affects an industry which, of course, operates globally. And that is a huge problem for the sector. And decarbonization is one of the topics where you can actually see it. You know, we are dealing with the European emission trading system, super expensive, and does it really make sense if you have the parallel discussion on a global scale to introduce a similar system? I would say it doesn't. I mean, we will manage it because we are an innovative industry and we can adapt, but we are a problem-solving industry, as Bud put it yesterday. I really like that term. But yet again, we are missing the part on the regulator side to actually come forward with innovative regulation and a clear commitment to regulate our industry internationally. And of course, that is for a regulator or for a politician, it's not easy, because in your constituency, you get your voters, and they most probably have never heard of IMO. But nevertheless, you know, you need that courage as a politician to commit to your goals on an international level. And that will be one of the challenges for the regulators to actually become innovative and support this innovative industry for the years to come.
Yes, thank you for that. And I'm going to stay with you, Martin, because I'd like you also now to think of one of the things that's come out of the answers you've just given is the need to act together in a uniform fashion. That applies as much to the regulator as it does to the shipping industry. And I wonder, with this industry, where you know, its very strength is its diversity and the range of interests in it, whether we have sufficient collaboration within the industry to ensure that our message is clear. I mean, the audience here today are all shipping folk, and I think somebody made the very good point yesterday that we need to reach beyond this room. We need to reach out. And if we're going to do that, we need to speak with one voice outside the industry. So are you confident that there is sufficient collaboration in the industry to get that single message across, that very powerful message you've all articulated. Martin, start with you.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, in the end, collaboration is key. But once again, you know, the collaboration is not only on the business side of life. Mm. It's also on the regulator side of life. So I'd like to throw back that question actually to the member states and IMO. Are you actually collaborating enough to introduce innovative regulation? Because we are collaborating all the time in the shipping business. Yeah. You know, we are pooling our ships, we are doing everything. But interesting part of, if you want to look at regulation, if it is innovative or not, we have this pain point of the EU Fuel Maritime, which sets a decarbonization standard for the fuels that we use, and it introduces a mechanism where you can actually pool your ships with the ships of your neighbor, the ships of your friend, or the ships of your opponent, or whatever. You can pool your ships to actually reach a certain decarbonization target. And I find that is actually a very innovative approach to foster collaboration in the shipping industry. The rest of the regulation is terrible, but this part of the regulation is actually something which is innovative, because we haven't seen that much in other regulation that we have faced over the past 20 years.
Okay. Emmanuel,
I would add, that regulation, in my opinion, would be a disaster without pooling. I don't think it could work.
Right.
Because theoretically, every ship would have to do exactly the same thing or better on the same date with fuels that don't exist yet.
Yeah.
And it's ironic that the Europeans and some others expressly opposed that for CII at IMO, where it would have been equally helpful.
Mm. Emmanuel, I can see you want to...
I think that, as I think all the others have said, the shipowners have been extremely responsible. Our association, much before, now I think it's already 3 years ago, that we have agreed, and that applies to the north and to the south, to the east and to the west, to the tankers and to the ro-ro, to the containers. So all that have different perspective and different business, we all agreed that we wanted 2050. And it is unprecedented, I think, in the history that the industry is asking the regulator to come out and to put some constraints and cost to the industry. So I think that we have moved with a huge sense of responsibility. I think it is unprecedented. Now it's time for the regulator to move. We have been pressing them to come with a solution. And we think that now there is a very good chance that within next year they will come with a fee-based proposal, which is something that we have been advocating since a couple of years, and which is the best solution. It's a win-win-win solution, because from one side, this would help to the uptake of new bunkers and the production of these new bunkers, particularly also probably in the developing countries. And at the same time, it will bridge the huge cost differences in the beginning between the new fuels and the old fuels, the thermal engine. Practically, we believe that the cost will be more or less the double. So it's a huge differential. And probably the 80% of this differential of cost could be covered by... And so this will leave only 20% for the shipowner, for the pioneers, to develop this and also to carry cargo on these new ships and with these new fuels. So I think it's a win-win-win solution. But we need to move. The time, I think we need that this decision has to be made within 2025. Cannot be later than that.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's sort of stay on the theme of government's role, regulators' role here. One of the great ICS initiatives, of course, is SEM Hubs, and I know both you and you, Bud, are quite heavily and very supportive of that. But what do we actually see government supporting us sufficiently? What is the role of governments and regulators in all of this? I mean, maybe...
So the SEM Hubs initiative, which ICS joined with IAPH and IRENA to develop, I think is a great idea. And it started as an experiment for us, because people like us and Guy Platten, who's the Secretary General of ICS, when we think of dealing with the government, we naturally go to the transport ministries. Well, you know, I think all of us would agree the primary problem here is fuel. It's not hardware, it's not will, it's fuel. And the energy ministers have proven to be a much more receptive audience to that point than the transport ministers ever could be, and the transport ministers can't deliver on it. So this, what started as an experiment, is something actually gaining momentum. And if you think about it, if I'm talking to a transport minister and I say, look, IRENA has said 50% of these advanced molecules will have to be transported by sea, as Manuel alluded to, well, first of all, we can do that as an industry, and we'll be there for you. Just tell us where the points of production and points of consumption are going to be in large scale. Let's start with that, and let's build hubs around both ends of that equation, which may be thousands and thousands of nautical miles apart, but we do that all the time. We can do it. And then we say, oh, yeah, by the way, you know that 4% of fuel consumption worldwide we use right now? We need some of that, too, for ourselves to decarbonize. It's been really productive. It is gaining momentum. I'm very optimistic about it. I want to echo Manuel's comments, which I think were right on, about the need for the regulator. And sorry, Mike, but while I'm holding the conch shell, I want to make a couple of points. I didn't mean to dodge the bait about nuclear, but I echo a lot of what Remy told us from DNV. In my experience as a naval nuclear engineer, pressurized water reactors, which are predominantly what you see on the 160 or so naval ships out there, are not well suited for commercial applications, and I would never see myself advocating for that. And I'm not going to advocate for the alternative, but what I am going to tell you, what we see today are a very different generation of reactors that require less operator intervention. They're more inherently safe. They're more compact. I see no technical reason why we could not be utilizing that technology on ships or ashore to create this massive amount of greenhouse gas-free energy that's required to create e-fuels. But is the public ready for it, and is the regulatory space going to be ready for it? I don't know, and those are big obstacles to be overcome. Second, I didn't really hit the point about long-term. I gave an illustration. But what underpins that is a company like Grimaldi Group, companies like MSC Group that are privately held, I think have a real distinct advantage, and many, many, many Greek ship owners are in the same situation where we can always think long-term. These are privately held family companies thinking about how to make the next generation lead this company in a better way than we were able to lead it before. And even though we're 200,000 people strong, we all feel like family members of our family company. When you have institutional investors looking on the outside in, they typically, especially if you're talking about private equity, do not have the patience it takes or the tolerance for the cyclical nature of this business, where if you look pre-pandemic, the liner business lost money 8 out of 12 years before the pandemic surprisingly turned things around. So, and then one last point, Manuel mentioned cost, and I think it's important, but we shouldn't talk about it in the abstract. This costs a lot. It costs a lot on the CapEx for us. It's going to cost a lot on the OpEx for the fuel. We heard DNV tell us maybe twice the cost to ship goods that it does today. We should not let people misunderstand. This is not a cost we can just eat into our cost basis and continue to provide services. Those costs will ultimately go into the market, or we will not have viable businesses to keep world trade flowing.
Excellent. I absolutely endorse what you said about nuclear. I think the new technology with molten salt reactors in particular is really very, very exciting. And it's the one fuel that actually delivers more bang. That's the wrong phrase, isn't it? But you know what I mean. It's the one that really actually does offer the opportunity to sort of power us more effectively and efficiently in the future.
It also invokes a reaction.
Right. Look, time is ticking down, so I'm going to wrap up. But I think what we've done over today, I'm quite inspired, actually. I think we've said, what does long-term leadership look like? I'm quite encouraged. I think it is there. I think you've given some really good evidence, all three of you, on that. But very quickly, because I can see the clock ticking down, can you perhaps just come up with one thing that you would like to see? So you're looking out there at people in their sort of 30s and their 40s, perhaps. What are they going to need? If you could give them sort of one example of something they're going to need to lead this information, to do your jobs, you know, in 10 years' time. Maybe. Emmanuel.
I have to reiterate what I said before. I think it's the feedback that we want, or something very similar, to be delivered in 2025 from the IMO. I think that is something that we really need, and right. We need.
Focus on
we
that.
We cannot do without, I think.
Okay, priority.
If we want to reach the goals that we have.
And Martin?
I'd like to ask governments to actually make large industry change possible. And you can make that possible by introducing consistent and reliable regulation. And that's what, to a large extent, is still missing, at least the reliable part. And, of course, please don't forget that shipping is not a cash cow. No, we are happy to pay a price on carbon, but please, if you want to, you know, encourage the industry to further decarbonize, give back the money for the industry to work on innovation and to decarbonize even further in the future. So, yeah.
Excellent. Great. And Bud?
Both great comments. I'm going to go a different direction. The regulators have a role to play with creating the right framework for this, but what we need to do is excite the next generations of people that are going to come in behind us and run this great industry about what we do and the value we add for society. As much as we try, we are not effective at doing that. And I wake up every day and I literally ask myself the question, what did you do today to make young people think this is a good industry to be a part of, it's exciting, and it serves a good purpose for the whole world? And I would encourage all of you to do that, and I would encourage regulators to help us with the right framework on training and certification.
Excellent. What a great note to end on. A round of applause, please, for our fantastic panel. Thank you.